Hello, friends, and welcome to Your Week with St. Luke's, the weekly podcast where we take a deep dive into the scripture text for this Sunday and give you the chance to learn God's story so that you can live, love, and lead a life following Jesus. I'm Pastor Melissa, and we are nearing the end of our Lenten journey, just a few weeks away from the story of crucifixion and resurrection. Now, we have one more week in the Gospel of John for this series, and again, we have Jesus describing what the kingdom of God is like, what discipleship requires of us, and what is going to happen to him that will unlock all of those possibilities. If you're following along in your own Bible, we are going to find ourselves in chapter 12 of John, so you can go ahead and turn there if you are following along. Now, we are still a week out from Palm Sunday and Jesus' triumphal entry in our church calendar. We'll be looking at that story next week, but it's important to know that in our text for today, in John's Gospel, that triumphal entry into Jerusalem has already happened. We find ourselves in Jerusalem with Jesus again at Passover, and for John, this is the third Passover in the Gospel. Now, like our other texts and passion predictions we've heard in all of our stories this Lent, we again need to back up in the gospel text for a little bit of context to understand what we are looking at. Now, before we get that triumphal entry, that moment is preceded by Jesus' visit to the home of Mary and Martha and their brother Lazarus, who he had just raised from the dead. This is the story where Mary uses expensive perfume to anoint Jesus' feet, and Judas gets really upset, and Jesus again gives a prediction of his death to come. And it's here that we learn that the healing of Lazarus was a huge turning point in Jesus' ministry. So if we start in chapter 12, verse 9, we hear, "Many Jews learned that he was there," and there being at Mary, Martha, and Lazarus' house. "They came not only because of Jesus, but also to see Lazarus, whom he had raised from the dead." And so the chief priests decided that they would kill Lazarus too. It was because of Lazarus that many of the Jews had deserted them and come to believe in Jesus. Oof, we are setting up some tension there because this is when crowds begin to follow Jesus. And people begin, as John puts it, to believe in Jesus. The chief priests, those are the ones who oversaw the temple worship, were feeling threatened because people were leaving their flocks and becoming part of Jesus' following. And that's the precursor to John's account of the triumphal entry, that Palm Sunday story that we all often know so well. Now, we're going to read that text from the Gospel of Mark next week, so we're going to skip over it today, but just remember, Jesus enters Jerusalem riding on a donkey. We then hear more about this crowd that was following him, so we are picking back up in verse 17. And it says, "The crowd who had been with him when he called Lazarus out of the tomb and raised him from the dead were testifying about him. That's why the crowd came to meet him, because they had heard about this miraculous sign that he had done. Therefore, the Pharisees said to each other, 'See, you've accomplished nothing. Look, the whole world is following him.'" Look, the whole world is following him, Jesus. That's what the Pharisees say to one another. And so now we get this second group of religious leaders, the Pharisees, who are feeling threatened by Jesus. They are fearful that their ministry is being rendered ineffective because they have lost power over these Jews who are now following Jesus. And they see so many people, they hyperbolically state that the whole world is following him now. And that brings us to our focus passage for today. We are focused this week on John 12, verses 20 through 33. Now remember, the previous phrase from the fearful Pharisees, "the whole world is following Jesus." And then we get to verse 20. "Some Greeks were among those who had come up to worship at the festival." Remember, this is the festival of the Passover. "They came to Philip, who was from Bethsaida in Galilee, and made a request, 'Sir, we want to see Jesus.' So Philip told Andrew, and Andrew and Philip told Jesus. Now, pausing here again. Here is yet again John's masterful ordering of this story. We hear the hyperbolic cry of the Pharisees that the whole world is now following Jesus. Well, at that time, they were really only seeing their world of Jewish faithful beginning to turn toward Jesus. But again, John's writer loves a good punchline. And as soon as that overblown statement is made, boom, we have Greeks coming to Passover. Now, that reference doesn't land nearly as well on us as it would first century readers. So Greeks would be from another part of the world. Greeks would have spoken another language. Greeks would have been Gentiles, not Jews. And they are asking to see Jesus. So John starts this section off again with the cosmic theme of universal salvation, that Jesus' impending death, resurrection, and ascension are not about a small group of chosen, but actually about, yes, just as the Pharisees said, the whole world. Not just the whole Jewish world, but the actual whole world. The arrival of these Greeks is another turning point for Jesus' story and for John's telling of it, because this means we are headed full steam ahead to the cross now. What Jesus had been telling all along, that he was going to suffer and die for the salvation of the whole world, well, the whole world is showing up now. And these Greeks have asked to see him. Now for John, seeing and illumination are related terms. That's an intentional pairing or connected language there. To see is to be enlightened. And as we heard in John's prologue, Christ is the light of the world. And it turns out the whole world is starting to notice Jesus. And noticing not only from afar, they are actually seeking to be his disciples. That's an intentional implication in their question of wanting to see Jesus. Furthermore, the disciples that they choose to talk to are the two of Jesus' disciples who have Greek names. And it specifies they're from Bethsaida, which is a bilingual town inhabited by both Jews and Gentiles. Now, we don't actually get to find out if they actually see Jesus or if what comes next is just something they overhear. But their appearance is a sign that all the eschatological promises we have heard from Jesus throughout the gospel are beginning to come to fruition. And so we continue with Jesus' response to this request that has been shared with him. We pick back up in verse 23. It says, Jesus replied, "The time has come for the human one to be glorified. I assure you that unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it can only be a single seed. But if it dies, it bears much fruit. Those who love their lives will lose them. And those who hate their lives in this world will keep them forever. Whoever serves me must follow me. Wherever I am, there my servant will also be. And my Father will honor whoever serves me." Now this section starts with that phrase of the time has come. Throughout the Gospel of John, the concept of the time or the hour that is coming is key. The time of Jesus' death, the time when the predictions will begin to be realized, the time of salvation is upon him. And it couldn't have come sooner because it wasn't yet time. Now, to further help his disciples understand the implications of what he's talking about, he shares a kind of parable. It's an agricultural metaphor. If you want to see me, this is what you will see. He wants to make clear that his death in this particular moment, he also wants to make clear what the end game is, that it's resurrection, that it's salvation, that it's discipleship. But he wants to understand that that's what the death is all about. It's about these other things that are coming. It's about the bearing of fruit. And he uses that idea of bearing fruit as the ultimate result of his life, death, and resurrection. That life doesn't end with death, but actually, because of death, we find more abundant life emerging. The writer of John fleshes this idea out, especially the implications for community in chapter 15 with that common that we've probably all heard, the vine and branches metaphor. I am the vine, you are the branches. And so the disciples are in some ways, and we as disciples are the fruit of what Jesus has accomplished. Now this discourse becomes equally about Jesus' death and about discipleship itself. He's already talking about what the disciples will do once he is gone. To follow is to do the works he has done. To follow actually in his footsteps, which is rooted in surrendering love. One article put it this way: there is a principle here that he invites his hearers to recognize as essential to real human thriving. As it is with him, so shall it be with his followers. It is by holding too tightly to our lives that we lose them. And it is by letting go of our lives that we enter into life most profoundly. Self-giving love, Jesus seems to say, is the currency of the life to come. Now, I want to be clear, the writer of John doesn't necessarily mean the life to come in the sense of an afterlife. They're talking about the life to come once Jesus has completed his mission, the life that is to come for these disciples once Jesus has accomplished his death, resurrection, and ascension. You know, that phrase, those who love their lives will lose them, and those who hate their lives in this world will keep them forever. Now, getting into a little bit of grammar here, in this verse, every verb and participle is in the present tense. So all of what is here is present reality, loving your life and losing it, hating your life and keeping it. That's not about the afterlife. This is actually a now concept, a fully present one, not now and then later, now and now. And so this moves us into our final section of the text that begins in verse 27. It starts with Jesus offering a little bit of insight into his own state. He says, "Now I am deeply troubled. What should I say? Father, save me from this time? No, for this is the reason I have come to this time. Father, glorify your name." There's a prayer in there, right? "Then a voice came from heaven. I have glorified it, and I will glorify it again. The crowd standing there heard and said, 'It's thunder.' Others said, 'An angel spoke to him.' Jesus replied, 'This voice,'" he specifies it's a voice, "says, 'this voice wasn't for my benefit, but for yours. Now is the time for judgment of this world. Now this world's ruler will be thrown out. And when I am lifted up from the earth, I will draw everyone to me.' He said this to show how he was going to die." So we now hear Jesus himself reflect on those feelings. While he has stated the factual information he knows to be true, and he wants the disciples to understand what is to come, we get this moment of introspective Jesus. We hear that he is deeply troubled. Some translations say that his soul is troubled, or his psyche is actually the literal word there. "Now I am deeply troubled. What should I say? Father, save me from this time? No, for this is the reason I have come." We probably recognize this sentiment of asking if he could avoid his fate from the prayer he prays in Gethsemane in the other Gospels. In Luke, he kneels in quiet dignity. In Mark and Matthew, he throws himself to the ground in his anguish. All of these are really emotional moments for Jesus. But John's Jesus, when he asks this question, he is not going to follow it up asking the cup to pass from him, as we see in other Gospels. John's Jesus recognizes his own inner conflict, but immediately states the affirmation of his calling. This is why he is here, and nothing is going to pull him away from this path. He wouldn't want anything else. And this section closes with another scene we might seem to have a familiarity with, but in a different context and with a slightly different agenda. Because we suddenly hear a voice from heaven responding to Jesus' affirmation of calling and further affirming it. It clarifies that the calling Jesus feels and is determined in is truly God's calling. Clarifies that this is the defining eschatological event, and we again get the imagery of him being, quote, lifted up. And this is the same thing that we saw in John 3, where Jesus referenced Moses and the bronze serpent. We also get again that classic Johannine technique of including a crowd of people who missed the point. The people can hear that there was some sort of disturbance, some sort of noise from above, but they can't understand it. They wonder if it's thunder or if it's angels. Now, they may not understand the specifics, but both thunder and angels tended to be understood as two of God's ways of messaging. So they likely got that what was happening was divine, but they didn't quite grasp the implications or what the specifics of the message conveyed. Now, your familiarity may be that you can recognize this is kind of John's version of Jesus' baptism moment that we see in the synoptics, where Jesus receives his calling when the heavens open and a voice is heard. But in this account, Jesus makes it clear that the voice that came from heaven wasn't from him, wasn't for him. John's Jesus has no question about who he is and what he's there to do. He doesn't need any more affirmation. And John also locates it differently toward the end of Jesus' ministry as an affirmation and confirmation of what was about to happen. So remember, John is most interested in the eschatological implications of Jesus' calling, how it impacts the whole cosmos, all of time. So placing this closer to the crucifixion event continues to make that cosmic connection. What we see here is that John's writer has taken traditional parts of Jesus' story that would have been shared among many communities in many forms. And just like the synoptic gospel writers, John has actually taken that same material, but many years later now has reshaped those stories to be able to fit this gospel's theological vision. Both the voice from heaven and Jesus' troubled spirit are reminiscent of scenes from the synoptics, but they are transformed here to accomplish a different purpose. So, what do we see here? Well, we see a Jesus who is ready for what is coming. We see a Jesus who is clear on his mission and is not in any way wavering from it. And we see a Jesus who is fully surrendered to God's will and to God's will alone. And then the implications for discipleship are clear. We are called to follow in Jesus' path. We don't always have to feel good about it, but we are called to allow ourselves to be surrendered to God's purposes, to listen for God's calling in every part of our lives. And that must become our singular focus. If you want to follow Jesus, understand that you too must be like him, a grain of wheat that falls into the ground and allows itself to die in order to bear much fruit. You can't hoard your life making survival your goal. You have to have a higher allegiance, one born out of belief in and following the Son of Man who is glorified and who glorifies God in his crucifixion and resurrection. And here in John, this advice on discipleship is set in a Christological context because Jesus is the supreme example of the one who finds by losing and who brings a great harvest by dying. This kind of surrender, the giving of oneself fully in order that much fruit might come for the whole universe, only Jesus can show love to us this way. And so we are called to show love as well by continuing to follow him to the cross. We'll see you next week.